This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with background and analysis from the correspondents who cover the news. And now from Washington, here's CBS News national correspondent Dan Rabin.
Happy holiday weekend, but not for GM workers. A lot of layoffs planned by the auto giant. Details in a moment. Then President Bush's trip to Asia and the Iraq debate that didn't go away. In Baghdad, CBS News correspondent Cammie McCormick will report on the Iraqi army. If it can handle the insurgents, Americans could leave. And whether it's patriotism or the need for a job,
recruiting stations are full, even though they're attacked regularly.
We'll also hear from CBS News legal analyst Andrew Cohen on Jose Padilla, alleged terrorist. Remember the original allegations touching on a dirty bomb plot?
That he was coming to the United States to engage in some sort of warfare here to kill U.S. citizens. And after 3 years, after confinement, after all these legal challenges to his status as an enemy combatant, we get this.
And a lot more ahead. But first, Detroit's biggest of the big three car companies will shrink to survive. 30,000 jobs being cut. Details from CBS News business correspondent Anthony Mason.
With sales sliding and losses soaring, GM announced sweeping job cuts and plant closings.
This has been a difficult period for all of us at General Motors.
CEO Rick Wagoner told his employees the company's U.S. workforce will be cut by about a quarter over the next 3 years as the world's largest automaker tries to get back on the road to profitability. But job cuts may not be enough for GM. Chubba Chetta of Car and Driver magazine says the company needs to make better cars and trucks.
Fundamentally, GM hasn't been producing the cars and trucks that people really want to buy. And when they push the sales up like they did last summer with the employee discount program, it works great from a sales standpoint, but it doesn't make any money for the company.
GM's good health isn't just important for the auto industry. It's estimated that directly or indirectly, almost a million people depend on GM for their jobs. So when General Motors suffers, the symptoms are felt through the entire economy. Anthony Mason, CBS News, New York.
When President Bush returned to Washington late Monday for less than 24 hours here in our nation's capital before Thanksgiving at his ranch in Texas, experts on Asia said they were not impressed by the results of his 8-day journey to Japan, South Korea, China, and Mongolia. That last stop, a former communist country, so friendly with the U.S., CBS's Bill Plant points out Mongolia has 120 troops in Iraq.
Mr. Bush, the first sitting president to visit this remote land, came to return the favor. He compared today's fight against Islamic radicals in Iraq to the fight against communism.
Free people did not falter in the Cold War, and free people will not falter in the war on terror.
The war followed Mr. Bush everywhere on this week-long trip, the more so because there was so little else to talk about. The president wanted Japan to roll back its ban on U.S. beef imports, which may yet happen, but didn't while he was there. Little visible progress was made at the Asian Economic Meeting. And during Mr. Bush's visit, Korea, the host nation, announced plans to bring home a third of its forces in Iraq. In China, the president was received politely, but with no fanfare and only vague promises of action on the big agenda items, the trade surplus, currency value, and intellectual property rights. He explains the U.S.-China connection as a work in progress.
We have a complex relationship, and it's a really important relationship. I mean, China is a big, growing, strong country.
He did have some fun, as CBS News chief White House correspondent John Roberts reported.
President Bush took a break from the diplomacy and daily attacks against his critics back home on Sunday, instead pounding the pedals on what will become the mountain biking course for the 2008 Beijing Olympic Games.
How do you say, take it easy on the old man?
The first cyclist headed out for a little friendly competition with Chinese Olympic hopefuls less than half his age.
Let's go.
He actually seemed to enjoy himself.
Just getting warmed up.
But with the heat still on in Washington over his Iraq policy, it wasn't long before the president was drawn back into the competition for political edge. Center stage again, Congressman John Murtha's call to pull troops out of Iraq.
I disagree with his position. An immediate withdrawal of our troops from Iraq will only strengthen the terrorist hand in Iraq.
The president was careful to say he has nothing but respect for the congressman.
Congressman Murtha is a fine man, he's a good man, who served our country with honor and distinction.
The gentle language stood in sharp contrast to an earlier White House attack, comparing Murtha to anti-war filmmaker Michael Moore.
From our White House correspondents who took that long trip to Asia, we turn to a CBS News political consultant, Craig Crawford, author now of a book called Attack the Messenger. Craig Crawford, you say the debate over Iraq is so sharp now because of opinion polls.
Yeah, two dramatic changes in the recent wave of polls, at least half a dozen. And we've all talked about the president's declining popularity and the feeling that he isn't credible, people saying he's not trustworthy. That is a new set of numbers for Bush. It suggests a personal problem that American people have with him that they didn't have before. The other difference is the slippage among moderate Republicans. You're always talking about conservative Republicans, evangelicals. The real base of the party are moderates, which we define as fiscal conservatives and social moderates. And there has been slippage in that group, and that's what's got the Republican Party so worried.
So if the Republicans seem to be in trouble right now, is that definitely good news for the Democrats for the 06 elections?
If they can take advantage of it. You know, Democrats, everything's going Democrats' way except for two things. They don't have a voice and they don't have a message. They need a messenger. They need someone in leadership that the public likes. I think some of the congressional leaders have limited appeal for the Democratic Party. And also a message. What is their message about Iraq, for example? There's an argument within the Democratic Party about an immediate withdrawal, a timetable, no timetable. So the Democrats aren't together on their response to this situation.
And you write, say in your book, Attack the Messenger, that often the status of the news media is also there in the debate. Members of the administration sometimes blame the news and the headlines for, in part, turning the public against the war.
Yeah, and Vice President Cheney's recent speech, he started that speech, his big defense of the war, attacking the messenger, blaming a wire service headline for seeming to imply that the feeling that the administration had become more partisan in its attacks came from the media overblowing the story somehow.
I do have a quarrel with that headline. I do not believe it is wrong to criticize the war on terror or any aspect thereof. Disagreement, argument, and debate are the essence of democracy.
This at a time that the news media are not very trusted either in the opinion polls.
Yeah, it works attacking the messenger because there's a receptivity out there in the public to do that. You know, I remember in the old days when I was a kid watching news shows with my parents and you'd see a politician dodge a question. We'd say, hey, he didn't answer that question. What's the answer to that question? Now you're more likely to hear people say, what a rude question. What's wrong with that reporter? What is he, liberal, conservative? The focus on the messenger, and this is what politicians have managed to do, is make the media the issue and distract the public from things they don't want to talk about.
Craig Crawford, who analyzes politics for us at CBS News and author of a book called Attack the Messenger, How Politicians Turn You Against the Media. Up next, we go to Iraq.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's Dan Revie.
U.S. troops continue to battle insurgents in western Iraq near the Syrian border, and there have been more suicide bombs and roadside bombs, killing Iraqis and Americans. The U.S. death toll in the war rose to over 2,100 this past week. CBS News correspondent Kimberly Dozier was in Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown, at a ceremony the U.S. military transferring control to Iraqis. But insurgents launched a reminder that they're not gone.
The American ambassador and the military's top brass had gathered for the handover of Saddam Hussein's massive palace complex there to the Iraqi government. Now, just as one of the American generals was standing to speak, we heard the whistling sound of incoming mortars, and everyone scattered. It took us a while to realize that none of the mortars had actually hit anyone. There weren't any injuries. The thing is, this was supposed to be a day about the symbolism of the Americans handing over control to the Iraqis. The insurgents got a word in, too.
American troop strength in Iraq is about 160,000. Soon after the election, December 15th, many U.S. troops should be departing, expected to leave 138,000. Now, Bush administration officials hint that within months, Iraqi forces will be able to take over more areas so U.S. troop strength can be cut. How are the new Iraqi security forces doing? A report from Baghdad by CBS News correspondent Cammie McCormick.
The U.S. military says there are more than 110,000 trained and equipped members of the Iraqi police. That's more than halfway to the goal of 195,000. And Major General Rick Lynch says recruiting stations are full, even though they're attacked regularly.
Since January, the Iraqi police have suffered 3,500 casualties and have been attacked 2,500 times.
The U.S. Embassy's political military counselor, Ambassador David Litt, admits security problems and intimidation by insurgents have been a problem, but one the Iraqis are working to overcome.
The Iraqi authorities themselves are trying to broadcast the message to Iraqi citizens far and wide. Even I have heard some of the religious authorities are trying to convince Iraqi citizens to join the forces to help protect Iraqi towns and families and cities from terrorism and insurgency.
But just as the forces will be a hard sell to possible recruits, so they are to many Iraqis, particularly Sunnis, who feel excluded and have lodged allegations of death squads and militias within the ranks of the security forces, made up mainly of Kurds and Shiites.
There are numerous reports of executions, of killings of individuals. They seem to be execution-style killings. What is important is the faith of the citizenry in the institutions and in the government authorities.
So recruiting Sunnis is key.
I believe that the Ministry of Defense and Ministry of Interior are trying to get more Sunni Arabs into the force, as well as to try to make as diversified a force as possible. That's essential for a nation that's as multi-ethnic as Iraq is, so that individual Iraqi citizens who look at their armed force, whether it's the military or the police, can with pride say, that's my army.
To end the insurgency, bringing Sunnis into the security forces may be just as crucial as their inclusion in the political process. For the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Cammie McCormick in Baghdad.
And from Iraq, we go two countries to the west, to Israel, a major change in the politics of that country. The Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon, has decided to leave his own political party and set up a new one. We turn to CBS News correspondent Robert Berger in Jerusalem. Was this a surprise or something you'd been expecting for some time?
Well, there had been a lot of speculation, Dan, that this was going to happen. Sharon felt that he could no longer govern because of rebels in the Likud that were opposed to his Gaza pullout. Well, he got away with the Gaza pullout. He outmaneuvered his opponents, but then they wanted revenge, and they were voting against all of his policies in parliament. So he found that he couldn't really govern this way and decided to abandon the party that he helped establish 30 years ago.
Who would be in his new party?
He's getting some people on board, some defectors from the dovish Labour Party, and also he's taking with him maybe up to 10 or 12 parliamentarians from the Likud party. That's 12 out of 40, so he's taking about a third of the party with him.
And he's such a strong figure in Israeli politics that even with a new political party, where normally you would think, oh, he can't win the election in March, he could.
Yes, so the polls show that he's going to do quite well. According to the latest polls, he would get about 33 seats out of 120 in the Knesset, Israel's parliament. Now, the Labour Party would get about 26 seats, but this would put Sharon into a position to form a pretty stable coalition, most likely, that would be basically centrist, appealing to middle-of-the-road voters.
It makes me wonder what would happen to the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, which I know is barely getting off the ground, but after the Gaza withdrawal, there should be something going on.
Well, the Palestinians are optimistic. They feel that the Likud was turning Sharon further to the right, and that now that he's broken away, that he may be able to make some kind of a deal with the Palestinians. I mean, Sharon has put his money where his mouth is, so to speak. He dismantled 25 Jewish settlements in the West Bank and Gaza Strip, so they think maybe they can deal with Sharon. But I have to say that I don't think Sharon is that optimistic that he can close a final deal, because Sharon is not willing, for instance, to give up East Jerusalem. But what he does want to do is draw defensible borders, and I think that's his goal, to do that with or without the Palestinians.
On Israeli politics, CBS News correspondent Robert Berger. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you.
Now to German politics. For the first time, a female chancellor heading the government there, Angela Merkel, born in West Germany 51 years ago, but brought up in communist East Germany. After the country reunified, she got into politics and rose to the top of the Christian Democrats Party, the CDU. 2 months ago, she ran against Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder, head of the other party, the SPD, the Social Democrats. You'll remember Schroeder was so opposed to the invasion of Iraq, he had bad relations with President Bush. The election was very close. Angela Merkel was the winner. She's had to form a coalition with the Social Democrats. Schroeder resigned. He's out of politics. As CBS News reporter Peter Bild in Berlin, relations with the Bush administration are going to get a lot better.
Certainly, Angela Merkel would not have been sending German troops into Iraq. Certainly, the Christian Democrats never believed that was possible. But they did strongly oppose the unilateral attitude taken by Gerhard Schroeder, which was to say, even if the United Nations were to approve intervention in Iraq, then Germany would not participate. It was that which she criticized. And not only in Germany, she actually went to Washington to do it. So she certainly endeared herself greatly to George Bush, who by that time was very fed up with Gerhard Schroeder. But I certainly think that when it comes to, if you like, alliances, political alliances, you will not find Moscow, Paris, and Berlin lining up against Washington and London the way you did then. So certainly, things are going to be easier on a personal level between the leaders of Germany and the United States.
Covering German politics, CBS News reporter Peter Bild in Berlin. Thanks, Peter.
It's my pleasure, Dan.
Up next, terrorism and then traveling with Condoleezza Rice.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Revie.
The legal fight against terrorism was in the spotlight Tuesday as Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez announced criminal charges against Jose Padilla. That's how the defendant likes his name to be said, though Gonzalez chooses otherwise.
The indictment alleges that Padilla traveled overseas to train as a terrorist with the intention of fighting and violent jihad.
Jihad, the word in Arabic for holy war. Note the word overseas. We turn to CBS News legal analyst Andrew Cohen. That's important. This indictment talks about a conspiracy to commit violence overseas. What happened to the original accusations that he was a would-be dirty bomber planning to use a radiological weapon, maybe blow up an apartment house in the U.S.?
Absolutely. That's the question. There is such a disconnect between the initial allegations against Padilla that he was coming to the United States, back to the United States, to engage in some sort of warfare here to kill U.S. citizens. And after 3 years, after confinement, after all these legal challenges to his status as an enemy combatant, we get this sort of a boilerplate claim against a terror suspect. He's accused essentially of recruiting other terrorists to do some sort of event overseas. The event was not specified in the indictment, and neither was he charged with any murder of anyone overseas.
It might be the only way to keep Padilla locked up. After all, there's that challenge to the Supreme Court over keeping him as an enemy combatant with very few rights. Maybe the feds sincerely believe he's a terrorist, but they can't make the case on the alleged crimes in the U.S.
I think the assumption has to be that the feds didn't want to let him go, that they were getting closer to having the Supreme Court force the issue on them. The Supreme Court was very likely to say either charge him with something or let him go. That's what his attorneys had been asking for the past few years. And so the feds, given that option, said, you know what, let's get out of this early before a U.S. Supreme Court ruling. Let's charge him. Let's sort of link him to these other terror suspects in Miami. Let's say that they're part of a conspiracy. And let's say that they were recruiting other terrorists to engage in terrorist activities overseas. Now, the good news, I suppose, for federal authorities, for prosecutors, is that federal law right now is so broad in this area that you really can get a life sentence against someone for engaging in activities which maybe 5-6 years ago would have been nowhere near close to that level of punishment.
CBS News legal analyst Andrew Cohen. Thanks, Andrew.
My pleasure, Dan.
In Washington, politicians from bitterly divided Bosnia, part of the former Yugoslavia, gathered to mark the 10th anniversary of the accord signed in Dayton, Ohio, that ended the Bosnian Civil War. More than 250,000 people died in that three-year conflict. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice helped broker a new deal to unify Bosnia with a new constitution.
We look forward to the future with unfailing hope. For we now have a tremendous opportunity to achieve real security and lasting democracy and true reconciliation in the Balkans.
It won't be easy, and this has been a month of challenges for Secretary of State Rice. She was on the president's trip to Asia, and before that, on her own journey to Arabia, Iraq, and the Middle East. CBS News correspondent Wyatt Andrews was with her.
We've had lots of powerful secretaries of state.
Dr. Condoleezza Rice.
But Condoleezza Rice has emerged as a rock star. She's often asked if she's running for president, but she denies it. But all is not well in her world. America's image abroad and her boss's popularity are sagging due to the violence in Iraq. Rice, though, told me she is encouraged about Iraq because the Sunni Arabs, the group deposed from power, will field candidates in next month's election.
They're engaged in this political process at great peril to themselves.
What's behind this optimism that democracy can triumph in Iraq? Is it typical political stagecraft from someone critics fear is over her head, or could it be bedrock belief? On a visit to hometown Birmingham, Rice, who was a child in the segregated South, compared the struggle for civil rights then to the struggle in the Middle East today. It is her past that tells her freedom finds a way.
So it was in America, so it has been in much of the world, and so it shall be in the Middle East.
Critics call her far too optimistic, but to her, this mission impossible is the kind of moment she's been seizing much of her life.
Let's follow up with CBS News correspondent Wyatt Andrews. When Condi Rice pulled an all-nighter to broker a deal over Gaza's borders, for instance, is a lot of her motivation humanitarian?
One thing that is hard to miss in Secretary Rice's comments is that she relates a lot of foreign policy goals to the will of the people. You know, we want to achieve democracy in Iraq, not for our security, but that's because it's what the Iraqi people want. We want to achieve democratic reform in Saudi Arabia, not because it's what America wants, but it's because that's what the Saudi people want. And similarly, with respect to the Palestinian state issue, there was a very interesting moment, Dan, in the press conference with Foreign Minister Saud of Saudi Arabia. He was asked about the status of things with Israel and the Palestinians and where they stood on that. And he said something to the effect, we need you, the United States, looking at the secretary, you, the United States, needs to solve the Arab-Palestinian statehood status issue. You need to solve that, he said, because it is one of the sources of terrorism. It is the recruitment poster for terrorism. And Secretary Rice turned around, answering the same question, and said, we need to solve the Israel-Palestinian state issue, maybe for these reasons, but the real reason we need to do it is because it will give the Israelis and the Palestinians a better life. I noticed, and other reporters noticed throughout this trip, that everything was couched in what the people need. So when she decided to pull this all-nighter, to broker this deal on exactly how do you open the board, three different border crossings within Gaza, one of which is on the international border with Egypt. There's no question that she wanted to do this because she has been hammered in the Arab world that every deal she comes to try to do, she's always on Israel's side and never on the Palestinian side. At the end of this deal, she can now claim that she got some legitimate concessions from Israel with respect to especially the border crossing with Egypt. And on this occasion, on this deal, and through this all-nighter, went to bat for the Palestinians.
And briefly, the trip that you made with her into Iraq, to Mosul and to the capital, Baghdad, was that a trip she had to make to show support ahead of the December 15th elections? Is there something specific that she wanted to accomplish?
One of the things that was noticeable on the trip to Iraq was that in two places, in Mosul, which is in the north, but it's also a Sunni area, in Mosul and in Baghdad, she took the time to meet with Sunni leaders. The Sunnis being the people who were deposed from power by the United States military, and the Sunnis being the people most in line with the insurgents. But she did this outreach with the Sunnis because the United States believes if the Sunnis will put forward a slate of candidates in the December 15th elections and participate heavily and win some seats in the coming National Assembly, that will be the ticket toward stabilizing in Iraq. The Sunnis will be in minority, but they'll have some shot at recapturing power.
Iraqi politics and so much more from CBS News correspondent Wyatt Andrews. And I'm Dan Raviv in Washington.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup, a wrap-up of the week with the correspondents who cover the news on the CBS Radio Network. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Once again, here's correspondent Dan Rabib.
The 14-year-old, after seeing her parents shot dead, willingly left with her boyfriend who had shot them. That's what prosecutors in Lancaster, Pennsylvania now believe, dropping the kidnap charge against David Ludwig, age 18. They say he admits murdering Kara Borden's parents after her father told him his daughter wouldn't be allowed to see him anymore. On the CBS Early Show, Julie Chen spoke about the case with a CBS News legal consultant, attorney Wendy Murphy.
If she is charged because she was part of the planning, if she is charged because she was sort of a co-conspirator, she will face murder charges, even if she didn't pull the trigger. And the important thing to know about this in terms of Pennsylvania law is because she's 14, she's old enough to be transferred to adult court, prosecuted as an adult, and face not the death penalty because of her age, but life behind bars.
But what would the charge be? Would it be aiding and abetting, just an accomplice? What would it be?
It depends on her level of knowledge and the extent to which she was involved in the planning, Julie. If she was part of the planning and this was an execution, this was something that they planned together. I mean, after all, he brought guns to the scene. This was not a fight. I mean, these were one gunshot to each of the parents' head. That's an execution-style slaying. And then he waited for her after the fact, as if they had agreed she would go with him after the murders. If that's what the story really is, she is just as guilty as he is. And I'm assuming a lot, I realize that. But she is as much responsible under the law as he is. And it doesn't matter whether you call it aiding, abetting, conspiracy, joint venture. The bottom line is she will face life behind bars.
David Ludwig reportedly confessed to the two killings. If that is indeed the case, is this an open and shut case against him?
Well, certainly it is against him. But again, Julie, they had a lot of time to spend together to plan what their stories might be in the event they were caught.
Yeah.
And the fact that he confessed means he is for sure likely to be convicted. Remains an open question about her.
A former district attorney in Massachusetts, Wendy Murphy. A lot of parents of teenage girls may wonder, would I know if she has a dangerous boyfriend who might have a gun or is a terrible influence on her? CBS Early Show anchor Hannah Storm spoke about that with Bethany Marshall, a family therapist in Los Angeles.
Well, there are several telltale signs you'll see if your daughter's in an abusive, exploitive, or unhealthy relationship. And one of those signs is alienation from family and friends. When your daughter goes to the mall with her boyfriend, you want her to feel that she can invite her friends along. Or if she comes home from a date, you want her to feel that she can get on the phone and talk to her little girlfriends about what she wore and where they went. But if friends start dropping off and her boyfriend is the only game in town, it's not a good sign. Also, if her personality starts to change, she becomes sullen, withdrawn, and you look at her and she seems like a stranger and she looks at you like you're the enemy, that's not a good sign. And the third thing is if you feel that her boyfriend is putting words in her mouth, if she uses phrases and words that are not characteristic of her, that's not good. It's okay to quote the Bible. It's not okay to quote your boyfriend.
Okay, so she's expressing some beliefs that on her own, that's another red flag. Secretive behavior is something that parents really need to be careful of. But how do we know the difference between sort of normal teenager searching for their own privacy and what might be considered a dangerous secret?
It's developmentally appropriate for teenagers to want privacy. They deserve to have their own private thoughts, their own private conversations, and their own private selves. But secretiveness is a whole different animal. Secretiveness is when she turns off that electronic leash, the cell phone. You call her and she won't pick up. Secretiveness is a type of vagueness that permeates everything about her. Secretiveness is when you feel she's someplace and you find out she's another. She says she's going to the prom and she turns up in another city. And we know about Kara Beth Borden and David Ludwig that many of their friends did not know they were in a relationship. It was a secret, and bad things grow in the dark.
Their parents tried to talk to them about this. Their parents went so far as to reportedly restrict her access to the internet because they did communicate that way. If your daughter is in an unhealthy relationship, what can you do? How do you start a dialogue and keep it going?
There are several things you need to do. First of all, children don't pursue their parents. Parents pursue their children. That means that if your child's in an unhealthy relationship, you need to step up your efforts and you need to create a better bond with your daughter. Spend time with her. Take her to the movies. Spend a weekend away with her. get your daughter to begin a dialogue with a family member or friend about what's going on in her primary relationship with her boyfriend so the bond of secrecy is broken. Develop a relationship with her boyfriend's parents. That's very important. And get her off the internet and into real life so that she's spending real life time with her boyfriend with the family.
Bethany Marshall, a psychologist and columnist in Southern California. Now to a positive role model, Bodie Miller, very famous if you know anything about skiing, and look forward to the Winter Olympics in Italy starting in 11 weeks. Two-time Olympic medalist Bodie Miller, author now of Go Fast, Be Good, Have Fun. Bodie, is this an autobiography? Because, heck, you're only 28.
I know. Now, a big part of the catalyst for the book was my co-author, Jack McEnany. He is a family friend, and I think he felt like he had a lot to contribute, and he knew that I had a lot of issues with the way that I was portrayed as far as just the accuracy. I was sick of trying to deal with the people, trying to put labels on everything.
You're that sort of hippie from New Hampshire who thinks athletes should be allowed to use drugs, and meanwhile you yourself are skiing up and down and getting ready for the Torino Winter Olympics. Is that about it?
I think you might have missed a few things in there, but I don't take vitamins. I don't take anything. I think any substance that applies to sports or applies to health or recovery should be regulated by the drug testing agencies. I think right now it's frustrating that there's things like creatine, the performance-enhancing drug, that's not regulated at all. And yet, there's ones out there that cause no harm to an athlete that are, getting athletes suspended and losing medals over and stuff like that. I just think the system is really broken right now, and it's frustrating that it's so taboo to even talk about it. You know, for me, it makes no difference one way or the other. I just think it at least should be talked about.
Bodie Miller, now you're a famous athlete, and maybe you didn't realize what comes with fame, right? That people will look up to you for advice, and you have to dispense it very carefully, maybe because you were homeschooled in the woods of northern New Hampshire. I mean, all of that is your rep. You didn't know what the real world is like?
I think it's probably closer to... I believe that people try to look for everyone else for their opinion of what's right and wrong. People want to say, oh, you're my role model. You need to do exactly what's right all the time so that I know what to do. You know, so parents are really actively trying to push that message, Look to this guy. He's your idol, or this guy is, or, you should be like that guy. And it's all about winning, and it's all about blah, blah, blah. The fact is, kids and people should do that on their own. You should look to yourself and think things through and decide what you think's right and wrong and decide what you want to be or who you want to be and not really look to idols to try to do that stuff.
Bodie Miller, champion skier for the United States, soon in the Winter Olympics in Italy. Best of luck. Thanks so much, Bodie.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Up next, stop eating. Tough on a holiday weekend. And then an amazing author, Kurt Vonnegut.
Stay with us on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Thanksgiving time, feeling full? Some weighty thoughts from our commentator, Charles Grodin.
This is from the New York Times. Evidently, there's some new hormone researchers have just discovered that sharply reduces the desire to eat. A new hormone. So far, they've tried it on mice, and it evidently sends a signal to the mouse's brain that says, eat less, and the mouse eats less. The scientists at Stanford University discovered it. It's evidently made in the stomach and the small intestine. I'm certain you have to go to medical school to know how you spot it or get it down there in the small intestine. Mice given the hormone for 8 days ate half as much as usual. It apparently slows the passage of food through the stomach, of course slowing down when you might next feel hungry. This has only been tested on mice, but drug companies are scrambling to come up with a way to get it to humans since our obesity rates are skyrocketing. An obesity researcher from the University of Washington said the chances that this is going to hold up in humans is very high. However, another obesity expert from the University of Cincinnati says the effect of body weight seems to be subtle. He means the mouse's body weight. Not only that, but the mice might be losing muscle weight, and that's not good. If we could get a pill that would make us eat less without our left arm eventually falling off, that would be good. I'm sure we could get a pill for everything, but when you read the potential side effects for just about everything we might take, it has to give you pause. I'm told drug companies have to report something even if it happened once, but we're not told that. Just what could happen, not the odds it will. I want to hear the odds, otherwise I'm not taking it. Of course, the mice don't get to read the side effects or the odds. I'm Charles Grodin for the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Now to a superstar of American literature, Kurt Vonnegut. He turned 83 this month. He's got a new book, and CBS's Bill Vitka discovered Vonnegut loves music.
Ink on paper isn't the way to tell a story anymore.
Take a ride with author Kurt Vonnegut to places that conquer space and time, threading the conventions of science fiction with the human drama. Science fiction lends itself to Vonnegut's universe, at once random and irrational, but in which wonder has a place, ingredients that are essential to the telling of his landmark story, Slaughterhouse-Five, about his own experience during World War II as a POW.
Boom, boom, boom. Right down.
Vonnegut was 23 when he was captured at the Battle of the Bulge. His division overrun, and the order to surrender came down.
We didn't think that was a very good idea. We didn't think the Germans were really very nice people, and so we decided to keep on going.
Then suddenly the Germans were on bullhorns telling you to give up, right?
They had a bullhorn of some kind and said, "We know where you are. Is come out." We didn't do anything, and so they fired some tree bursts over us, and we decided maybe they had a point after all.
Vonnegut was imprisoned in Dresden. It was there beginning February 13, 1945, where the Allies firebombed and destroyed a city of no military significance.
We were lucky to be quartered in a slaughterhouse anyway, where there were meat lockers under the street, which turned out to be very good air raid shelter. It was the British who burned down Dresden. And they did that at night, and then American planes would come over in the daytime and drop high explosives to discourage the firemen.
You said you had to grow up before you could write Slaughterhouse-Five, before you could write that story.
I had to become truthful.
It took Vonnegut 24 years to get there. The book he wrote, though, was not the idea that he began with. The original plan, needing to feed his family, was to write a funny war story, have it made into a movie, and in his mind's eye, Vonnegut was already casting roles.
Maybe with Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra. And I visited this my war buddy, Bernie O'Hare, to help me remember, you know, funny stuff. Be good in a movie. And his wife, Mary, blew her stack. She said, "You were just babies then." I had to confront the truth of that, and finally wrote as truthful a book, as mature a book as I could.
Vonnegut is the author of a new work, a collection of essays called Man Without a Country, joining more than 20 books, including Mother Night, Cat's Cradle, and The Sirens of Titan. For a man who often delves into the lexicon of science fiction, the future is what he believes mankind doesn't have, but he also believes there are nurturing properties to being alive.
The only proof of the existence of God I need is music.
So music is as close to divinity as we can find
it
in ourselves.
Oh, it is, yes. I have said, you know, a function of the arts is to make people like life more than they had before, and then I'm asked if I'd ever seen the arts do this, and I said, yes. I said, the Beatles did it.
You are a particular admirer of the blues.
Yes, again, because they work. And how they work, I don't know. But Al Murray, who's a jazz historian, told me, per capita, the slave owners had a much higher suicide rate than the slaves. And he thought this was because the slaves had a way of dealing with depression, and it was the blues.
I live the life I love, and I live the life I live.
Why the name of the book, Man Without a Country?
What the United States I love so much, had such high hopes, and in such large measure has disappeared. The dreams I had for this country have not come true.
You say you know few people today dreaming of a world for their grandchildren.
That's right.
You have grandchildren.
And I'm very sorry about what a terrible planet we've prepared for them.
People are crazy and times are strange. I'm locked in tight, I'm out of range. I used to care, but things have changed.
In Man Without a Country, Vonnegut says he's been writing a novel where, against the backdrop of the end of the world, we meet a stand-up comedian.
It's good news and bad news tonight, friends and neighbors. The bad news is that the Martians have landed in Manhattan and they've checked in at Waldorf. The good news is that they only eat homeless people of all colors.
So are you writing that book?
No. For one thing, I'm old. I'm pretty much written out.
Faith alongside despair. Not the only seeming contradictions, because after pledging that he has written his last, this unclassifiable American original finds himself with a bestseller.
Yes, life is so peculiar, but as everybody says, that's life.
For the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Bill Fitka.
Louis Armstrong and Louis Jordan among the music greats you heard. And if you like MP3 downloads, search for Weekend Roundup. You'll find this broadcast, certainly at cbsnews.com. Get us on the internet, and please stay tuned to this radio station. I'm Dan Revive. Bye.
You've been listening to the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The program is produced in the Washington Bureau of CBS News. The executive producer is Howard Arenstein. This is the CBS Radio Network.